I want to welcome those who are listening to the podcast. We are at lesson number 7 in a series entitled Between the Testaments. And this evening we're going to begin our look at what is called the Hasmonean dynasty. I've already told the very good group of men and women who are in the room tonight that we're beginning a 2-part study that is the most neglected subject in terms of Christians and our understanding of the time period between the Testaments. It's a complicated subject that I hope to make very simple for you this evening. When I use the phrase the Hasmonean dynasty, I want you to think of it like this. Hasmon is a surname, a last name. My surname is Burleson. It would be like me saying the Burleson dynasty. I am speaking of people named Hasmon and their descendants who ruled Israel during a specific time between the close of the Old Testament and the opening of the New Testament. It is an incredible time of history that you can read about in the apocryphal books, 1st and 2nd Maccabees. But in order to understand this time period, I've got to give you some background, a review, some explanation, and then we'll launch right into it. Because the truth of the matter is, if you pick up 1st Maccabees, and if you go to a Roman Catholic church, when you pick up your Bible, you are picking up 1st Maccabees because they include the Apocrypha in their Bible. But let's say you pick up a book that has 1st Maccabees and you open up to that book and you begin reading, you will not understand it unless you comprehend the background that I'm about to give you. So, let's begin. The Hasmoneans are also called the Maccabees. That is a nickname for the family of Hasmon. And as I've shared with you in the past, the word Maccabee is an acrostic for Exodus 15, verse 11. A couple of you came up last week and said, Pastor, in the notes it said Exodus 11, 15, and I am sorry, that was a typo. The numbers were transposed. Exodus 15, 11 in the Hebrew says, Mikamako Ba'elim Yahweh. And if you take the first letters of each of those Hebrew words, you get Maccabee. It's an acrostic. Now, it's a little bit like the word ichthus. You know what ichthus means in Greek? Fish. And do you remember how Christians in the early days after the resurrection of Christ would identify themselves? They would draw a fish, an ichthus, because ichthus is also an acrostic. Iisus, Jesus, Christos, Huios, Soterios. Jesus Christ, God's Son, Savior. Okay? So Maccabee is an acrostic of the Hebrew, which translated into English means, who is like unto thee among the gods, O Yahweh. And the reason this became the Hasmonean battle cry is because they were fighting the Greeks, who believed in many gods. The Greeks were polytheists, and the Jews believed in one God, Yahweh. And so when they'd go into battle, Maccabee was their battle cry. And by the way, I shared with you last week as well that the word Maccabee is also the Hebrew word for hammer. And many people believed that the Maccabees, the Hasmoneans, who led Israel during this time, were like a hammer to the Greeks. They pounded them. Okay? I will give you the 5 kingdoms that rule the world before the time of Christ so often that it will become second nature to you. You'll be able, by the time we're done, to say it for yourself. As we have said in the previous weeks, before the coming of Jesus, since the creation of man, 5 nations ruled the world as empires. An empire is a country that conquers another country and then imposes a tax on the countries that have been conquered. And there have only been five empires prior to Christ. The first one was the Assyrian Empire, beginning in 911 BC until 609. The second one is the Babylonian Empire. They conquered the Assyrians. And the Babylonians only reigned as a world empire for 70 years. And those 70 years from 609 to 539 BC were prophesied by the prophet Jeremiah. And then the Persians, remember we've explained how they conquered the Babylonians when Cyrus, the king of Persia, diverted the Euphrates River under the city of Babylon and his army marched underneath the great walls of Babylon. You read about it in Daniel chapter 5, the night that Belshazzar was having a great party in his palace. The Persians entered that night and he was conquered because he had been weighed in the balances of God's justice and had been found wanting. That was the end of the Babylonian Empire and the rise of the Persian Empire. And Cyrus is mentioned in Isaiah 150 years before Cyrus was even born, called the Messiah of God, bringing Babylon to an end so that God's people, the Jews, could return to Israel. Because remember, during the Babylonian Empire age, in the year 586, Babylon descended upon Judea, destroyed Jerusalem, and took the Jews into captivity. This is the major event of the Old Testament. If you want to understand the Old Testament, you've got to know 586 BC is the key. The fall of Jerusalem, the destruction of Solomon's temple. It is destroyed by the Babylonians. All the prophets before the Jews are taken into exile are called pre-exilic prophets. All the prophets that prophesy to Israel after 586 when the Jews are taken into Babylon are called post-exilic prophets. Everything in the Old Testament revolves around the exile of 586, which occurred during the Babylonian Empire days. Cyrus the Persian released the Jews to go back and to Israel, and they rebuilt the temple under Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah. And then, as we saw last week, the Grecian Empire rises because Alexander the Great is born. And he decides he's going to pay back the Persians for burning Athens to the ground. And so he gets on his horse, Bucephalus, and takes his army to Persia to defeat the Persians. And the Grecian Empire becomes the world's fourth great empire. And this is where we are in our study. To understand the Hasmonean dynasty, you've got to understand the Grecian Empire. Now, let me just say a word before we continue. When Alexander the Great conquered the world and defeated the Persians, you must understand when the Jews came back to Israel after Cyrus released them from captivity in Babylon, they found their city destroyed, the temple in ruins, and it took them a while to rebuild everything. But when they rededicated the temple 70 years after it was destroyed, they rededicated it in 516 BC. After it was destroyed in 586 BC. They didn't become an independent nation at that time. They paid taxes to Persia. They had Persians who ruled over them. You read about this in Nehemiah and in Ezra and in Malachi. They were subjects to the Persian kingdom. Now, when the Greeks conquered the Persians, Judea became subjects of Greece. You've got to understand that when Zedekiah was killed by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and you read about it in the last chapter of Chronicles, his eyes are gouged out, but the last thing Zedekiah sees before Nebuchadnezzar gouges his eyes out is every one of his sons being murdered in front of him. So the last thing seared into his memory is he has no descendants to be king of Israel. And then he's put in chains, blinded, he is taken into Babylon. That is the last king of Israel until we come to the Hasmonean dynasty that we're going to be talking about tonight. But there's a problem with the Hasmoneans that I'll explain in just a moment. They don't come from the line of David. And because of that, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes get really upset. And I'll explain that in just a moment. Alexander the Great conquers the world. When he dies in 323 BC, his kingdom is divided into four parts, which eventually merges into just two kingdoms. The Seleucid kingdom, which is called the kingdom of the north, and the Ptolemaic kingdom, which is called the kingdom of the south. Now, if you're looking at the map in the room, you notice that the Seleucid kingdom is much larger than the Ptolemaic kingdom. The Ptolemaic kingdom is North Africa. It's Egypt. It's the richest part of the world. Alexandria was built there by Alexander himself. It's a great port city. And so all kinds of riches along the Red Sea and the Mediterranean in North Africa. But it's small. The Ptolemaic kingdom is a kingdom ruled by the Greeks, by General Ptolemy, one of Alexander's best friends who grew up with Alexander. When Alexander died at the age of 32, Ptolemy got Africa. General Seleucus got what is called the Seleucid kingdom. It's a major swath of land from India to the Mediterranean, and it's north of Ptolemy. Now, here's the reason this is important. These are Greek kingdoms. If Alexander had lived, we would call this the Grecian Empire, because it is Greek. But because he died, we call it the Seleucid kingdom and the Ptolemaic kingdom, named for his major generals. Alexander had no heirs. Many people believe that he was unable to conceive children because of venereal disease. He had many wives, but he had no sons. So his generals divided the kingdom. Now, as we have said, and this is critical to your understanding, Israel is the borderland between the kingdom of the north, the Seleucids, and the kingdom of the south, the Ptolemies. And after Alexander's death and the division of his kingdom, Greeks began fighting each other because Seleucus wanted Africa and Ptolemy wanted Seleucia. And so you have this great battle taking place between the north and the south with Israel right in the middle. By the way, if you open up to the book of Daniel chapter 11 and you begin reading, you read it and you're just like lost because it says, and the king of the north goes south and makes battle against the king of the south. Then the king of the south goes north. And you read that and you think, who is this? What is this? Well, I'm telling you, that's what Daniel 11 is about. Okay? Now, let's go on. Because the Seleucids and the Ptolemies were Greeks, they worshipped the Olympic gods. They were polytheists. They worshipped many gods. And a picture of Mount Olympia, which could be seen all over Greece. These were the 12 major Greek gods. Zeus, Hera, Athena, Apollo, Poseidon, Ares, Artemis, Demeter, Aphrodite, Dionysus, Hermes, and Hephaestus. These were the Olympian gods. Now, where did they come from? I haven't told you this before, but I think it's quite fascinating. My hero, the guy that I study more than probably anyone, is Isaac Newton. I believe he is probably the smartest man who's ever lived. He was a scientist, discovered the laws of gravity. He was a naturalist, but he was also a biblicist. He knew Hebrew, he knew Greek, he knew Latin, and his hobby was chronology. And Kronos was the father of the Greek gods. We get our word chronology from that, who married a woman named Tychius. Isaac Newton believed Kronos was Noah, and his wife was Tychius by name. Their children became the Olympian gods. These, Cronus, was part of what's called the Titans. And today, in Western culture, particularly in the movies, all the kids are fascinated about the war between the Titans and the Olympians and so on. But Zeus is the head of the Olympic gods. Now, in the days between the Testaments, between the close of the Old Testament and the opening of the New Testament, the entire known world worshiped the Olympian gods because Greece had conquered the known world. And if you're paying taxes to the king of Seleucia or to the king of Ptolemy, you're going to also have to worship their gods. And that's exactly what was demanded of Israel. The king of the north eventually dominated Israel. And the king of the north in 175 became a man by the name of Antiochus IV, and he called himself Epiphanes, which means God revealed. He believed that the Olympian gods would be revealed through him because he was the Olympic gods manifested to man. Now, he was a wicked, evil man who controlled Israel. And he didn't like the Jews because there was resistance to the worship of the Olympian gods, and there was resistance to calling him Epiphanes, God manifested. So he was going to teach these Jews who were paying him taxes, who were subjects to him, he's going to teach them a lesson. So he marched on Jerusalem and issued a law telling the Jews that you cannot circumcise your children, you cannot study the Torah, meaning the first five books of your Old Testament, the law of God, and you cannot keep the dietary laws. This was a law. And do you know what happened if you violated the law of Antiochus Epiphanes? You died. You were killed. In fact, one of the ways that he loved to kill people is to hang them on a cross and bring family members out and kill family members as you were dying yourself. He was a wicked man. And the awful thing that he did in December of 167 BC is he erected a massive statue of Zeus in the temple of Jerusalem. We're talking about the temple of God that you read about in the Old Testament. We're talking about that temple that was rebuilt by Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. Here comes Antiochus Epiphanes IV, and he builds the statue of Zeus in that temple. And then, on top of that, he orders the high priest to take a pig and offer a pig, an unclean animal, to Zeus in the very place where every morning and evening a lamb would be offered to Yahweh. And then he sends his messengers out to all of the cities around Jerusalem. And he tells the priests in those cities, because remember now, you were a priest if you were a Levite, but you could only be high priest if you were a direct descendant of Aaron, firstborn son of the family of Aaron. He sends out orders through his messengers that everyone was to offer a pig to Zeus in their home cities. Now, before we go any further, what Antiochus Epiphanes did in December of 167 BC is written about in the book of Daniel. Now, I want you to open up your Bible to the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 11. And I want to show you something. It's not in your notes, but it's worth knowing. And by the way, tonight, like we've done the last couple of weeks, if you'll just listen to me, your notes will contain everything that I'm talking about, but I think it would be better to just watch the slides and listen rather than trying to follow along in the notes. In Daniel chapter 11, Daniel is describing the battle between the Seleucid king, the king of the north, and the Ptolemaic king, the king of the south. And in verse 15 of Daniel 11, he speaks, "Then the king of the north will come." And then he starts talking about the king of the north and alliances that he makes and so on. And then dropping down, take a look at verse 31. "Forces from him," the king of the north, the Seleucid king, Antiochus IV, Epiphanes as he is known, will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, meaning the temple, do away with the regular sacrifice, meaning the morning and evening sacrifice for the nation of Israel. And they, the forces that come from him, will set up, and here's the phrase, the abomination of desolation. The abomination of desolation is the erection of the statue of Zeus in the temple of God in Jerusalem. It's called the abomination of desolation. Now, as we saw last week, when the messenger from Antiochus Epiphanes goes to a little community called Modiin, M-O-D-E-I-N, just a little bit to the northwest of Jerusalem on your way to the Tel Aviv airport today. In fact, we were driving by Modiin this spring. On our way to the airport with a group of people from our church, our guide, who's an Israeli paratrooper, lives in that city. And as we were driving, everybody was asleep. It was late at night, about midnight. And I said, "Wow, you live in the city of Mattathias." He goes, "What? You know about Mattathias?" I said, "Oh, sure. In fact, you're living in the city where all of his sons have been buried." He goes, "Absolutely." And we had a great talk about Mattathias and the Hasmoneans. Their home city was Modiin. In that city, in December of 167, the messenger from Antiochus Epiphanes comes and he tells one of the local Levitical priests, take a pig, offer it to Zeus, face toward the temple in Jerusalem, and make your prayers to Zeus. Well, so the priest gets his pig, the unclean animal, and he is about to slay it and offer it to Zeus when Mattathias, his grandfather's name was Hasmon. Mattathias Hasmon. He's called Mattathias the Maccabee. He slays his brother Jew. He kills him. Then he turns his sword against the Greek official who made this happen. And it is the beginning of what is called the Maccabean Revolt. The Maccabean Revolt, the Hasmonean time period, begins in December of 167, the month when Zeus, the statue of Zeus, was erected in the temple. And it goes all the way till 37 BC, 130 years, where the Maccabees are leading Israel to independence from the Greeks. Now, let me just jump to 37 BC. Do you know what happens in 37 BC? Yeah. There's a fellow by the name of Herod, an Idumean. We call him Herod the Great, but he was more wicked than Antiochus Epiphanes. And when we get to Herod the Great in about 3 weeks, it'll turn your stomach what he did. He declared himself king of the Jews, and he ended the Hasmonean dynasty, and King Herod is the king when Jesus the Messiah is born. And you're going to understand why King Herod was so disturbed when the wise men from the east came asking, "Where is he who is born king of the Jews?" Because Herod did everything within his power to get rid of the Hasmoneans, who had called themselves the kings of the Jews, to become king of the Jews himself. Okay? So, the Hasmoneans, they are Jews who are overthrowing the Greek rule of Israel. Now, after Mattathias killed his fellow priest in his home city of Modiin, he cries out to the people, and you read about this in 1 Maccabees 2, verse 27. "Let everyone who has zeal for the law and who stands for the covenant," meaning the covenant of God with the Jews, "follow me." This is the beginning of the Maccabean Revolt. Now, let me say this again. When Babylon conquered the Jews and destroyed the temple and gouged out the eyes of Zedekiah, Israel no more had a king. They go into captivity. When they get out of captivity under Cyrus the Persian, they still don't have a king. They are subjects to Persia. When the Greeks conquer the Persians, they still don't have a king. When Antiochus Epiphanes comes and puts the statue of Zeus in the temple, the Jew says, enough is enough. And they say, we are fighting to the death. This is the beginning of the Maccabean revolt. Who is like you among the heavenly gods, Lord? Again, there's the typo. It's Exodus 15, verse 11. Mattathias had five sons. I've got three boys. And I'm very proud of my boys. Mattathias had five boys. And all of Israel is proud of these boys of Mattathias. They are called the sons of Maccabee. They're the Hasmoneans. You have John, you have Simon, Judas, Eliezer, and Jonathan. And shortly after Mattathias made his courageous effort to gather the Jews around him to throw off the Greek rule of the Jews, Mattathias died. We are not told why, but you read about it in 1 Maccabees 2. Some think it's old age. Some think he had a disease. But he's well enough to call his five boys around his bedside. And you can read about what he says to them. He says, boys, you must continue the fight. We would rather die than offer our offerings to Zeus. Okay? So the man who takes over is his son, Judas. Now, he's not the oldest. He's the third born. But in the anointing that you read about in 1 Maccabees, it reminds me of when Jacob, as an old man, calls his boys, the sons of Israel, around, and he blesses them and he prophesies about them. This is what Mattathias does in 1 Maccabees 2. And he says of Judas, Judas, you are the hammer. You are the hammer. Go defeat the Greeks. Some people call him Judah Maccabee. But I like Judas Maccabeus. That's what most historians call him. He becomes the leader of the Hasmoneans, the leader of the Maccabees. But remember, he's not king. He's just leading. He's fighting. He's a general. And exactly 3 years to the date, after the statue of Zeus had been erected in the temple in Jerusalem, in December of 164 BC, Judas, with his men, break in to the walls of Jerusalem, defeat the Greek soldiers that are encamped there, and liberate the Temple Mount, take out the statue, decompose the altar which had been polluted by the blood of pigs, and cleanse the temple, rededicate it to Yahweh. And it is what we call Hanukkah. Hanukkah, which means to rededicate. The word Hanukkah in Hebrew means dedication. And it is used in Psalm 30 and verse 1 in this manner, a song for the dedication of the house of David. And you see in the Hebrew the word Hanukkah or Hanukkah. So here's what you need to understand. Every December, when you walk into a store and you hear Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, joyous holidays, and so on. And you think, oh, it's all about Jesus, all about Christmas, and so on. No, 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 no. Hanukkah predates Christmas by 160 years. And Hanukkah is a celebration of the cleansing of the temple in Jerusalem. It was an existential fight for the Jews. They were throwing off the Greeks for their nation, for their religion, for their worship of Yahweh. This is a solemn time for the Jews. Now, they call it the Festival of Lights. As I mentioned to you last week, the reason it's called the Festival of Lights is because the only thing that they found in the temple that was pure was a little vial of oil that was used to light the candelabra in the holy place. And they had enough maybe for a few hours of oil. But the tradition The Jewish tradition says that they poured that oil into the candelabra, and the candle stayed lit not one day, not 2 days, not 3 days, not 4 days, not 5 days, not 6 days, not 7 days, but 8 days. That's why Hanukkah is called the Festival of Lights and lasts for 8 days. But you need to understand it's a celebration of the Jews throwing off the Greeks. 8 day celebration in December, and it is not Christmas. Not even close. Okay, but you know what? I would have zero problem wishing a Jew happy Hanukkah. In fact, when I see Jews, from the depths of my heart, Roy, I will say to them, happy Hanukkah, because it was for the survival of their nation. And I have zero problem doing that. I'm just trying to encourage you not to confuse the two. Make sense? Okay. By the way, Jesus visits the temple during Hanukkah. In the Gospel of John, chapter 10, verses 22 through 23, the Bible says, at that time, the feast of the dedication took place at Jerusalem. It was winter. By the way, you farmers, we are on the same latitude as Jerusalem, Enid, Oklahoma. You know what that means. It means if you go out on 412 and you just keep driving and drive over the ocean, you're going to end up in Jerusalem. Okay? All right, but here's the thing. That means the seasons are the same. So in the dead of winter, it's December. Because it was the dead of winter, Jesus was walking in the temple in the portico of Solomon. By the way, this right here, I'm sorry for those of you on the podcast, you're not looking at the portico of Solomon. But the portico was the porch, the patio of the temple of Solomon. And it's on the eastern side. Jesus was walking right behind this wall on the eastern side of the porch of Solomon, and it was the Feast of Dedication. Now here's the thing. If you don't know the history between the Testaments and you're teaching fourth grade Sunday school class, and you come to the Feast of Dedication, you have a little boy raise his hand and said, what's the Feast of Dedication? And you have zero understanding from the Old Testament because it didn't exist. Are you with me? This is why the study between the Testaments is extremely important. Okay? So it's mentioned. The Feast of Dedication, Festival of Lights, Hanukkah, whatever you want to call it. Judas Maccabeus is the Jew that also makes first contact with the Romans to form a treaty. Now, I'm going to read for you from 1 Maccabees chapter 8. And I've got the Apocrypha here, and I just want to read for you four verses of Scripture. Remember who Judas Maccabeus is. He is the third of five sons of Mattathias. He takes over leading the Maccabean revolt when Mattathias dies in about 166 BC. He is the Jew who leads the Jewish army onto the Temple Mount to throw off the Greeks in December 164, exactly 3 years after the abomination of desolation. Let me read for you in 1 Maccabees chapter 8. Listen to what Judas does. Judas Maccabeus heard of the fame of a people called the Romans, that they were very well disposed toward everyone who wished to make an alliance with them. He had heard that the Romans pledged friendship to those who came to them, and that the Romans were a very strong people, how they had defeated the Gauls, that's what we call the French, how he had forced them to pay tribute, and how he had conquered the land of Spain and gained control of their silver and gold and the entire region. So Judas sent an entourage to Rome. This is the first time that the Jews come in contact with the Romans. So by the time the New Testament opens, Romans are everywhere. How did we get from Judas sending an entourage to Rome to make a treaty with the Romans because he's fighting the Greeks and he wants the Romans, who are also fighting the Greeks, to be on their side? How do we get from him having to send messengers to Rome for a treaty. Two, by the time the New Testament opens, Romans are everywhere in Jerusalem. Well, you'll have to come back the next couple of weeks, and I'll tell you, okay? Now, before we go any further, I want to show you one final thing that I think you'll find very interesting. Go back to Daniel chapter 11. In Daniel chapter 11, the prophet Daniel beautifully describes what is going to happen in terms of world empires. The whole book of Daniel I love. He talks about the Assyrians, how they are defeated by the Babylonians, how the Babylonians are defeated by the Persians, how the Persians are defeated by the Greeks, how the little horn, Alexander, leads the Greeks. His kingdom is divided into four. I mean, and then the Romans arise. Daniel describes it all. He is so accurate that many people, many scholars, many Hebrew scholars, say there's no way Daniel wrote this. Daniel lived, as we all know, in the 6th century B.C. And there's no way he could have known about the Persians or the Greeks or the Romans. And so they say someone who claimed to be Daniel wrote it in the 2nd century or 1st century. And everything had already happened because it's impossible for a man to know the future. So that's what they'll say. Now, here's the thing. I believe Daniel wrote Daniel for various reasons. It could have been edited by someone else, but I believe Daniel, who lived in the 6th century, wrote Daniel. After you come to the end of Daniel 11, and everything that happens with the Greeks and the Romans, Daniel chapter 12, remember, there's no chapter divisions in the scroll of Daniel. You just keep reading. Look at Daniel 12, verse 1. Now at that time, Michael shall arise. Michael is a Hebrew term for the Messiah. Now I realize today, good night, this will get you in huge trouble. Every evangelical Christian who reads Daniel chapter 12, they call Michael an archangel, and they talk about this being the future tribulation and all that kind of stuff, something that hasn't happened yet. But what I'm telling you is, Daniel is describing the events that lead to the birth of the Messiah. And then drop down to verse 4 of Daniel 12. As for you, Daniel, conceal these words and seal up the book until the end of time. Seal this scroll until the end of time. Okay? Now, if you will, keep your finger right there where God tells Daniel to seal the scroll and turn to Revelation chapter 22. Revelation chapter 22. Revelation is called the little Daniel. Basically, in Revelation, you have John writing about the end of time. And again, modern evangelicals always talk about Revelation as not yet having occurred. That it's something future. It's the end of the world, the battle of Armageddon, the Antichrist, and so on. But take a look at Revelation chapter 22, verse 10. And he said to me, "Do not seal up the words of the prophecy of this book, for the time is near." Now, wait a minute. Why is Daniel told to seal up the scroll of his book, but John, the writer of Revelation, the little Daniel, is told, don't seal up the scroll of the book because the time is near? Are you ready? I believe what Daniel is writing about is the coming of the Messiah, who will end God's covenant with the nation of Israel and launch an eternal covenant with the world, Jews and Gentiles. And that John, writing Revelation, is describing how that end is officially occurring with the destruction of the temple in AD 70. Revelation was written in 68 AD, and it's describing the great battle that was coming to officially end the covenant of God with the Jews. And the angel says to John, don't seal up the scroll because the time is near. But Daniel's scroll was to be sealed up, because the time was still far away, 500 years. At that time, Michael will arise. Now, as I've said to you in the past, Daniel lived in Persia until he died, and he opened a school of the Magi. And it was his scroll. And I believed he trained the Persian Magi to know when the Messiah of, listen to this now, the world would come. Not just the Jews, the world. And so when the Magi from the east came to Bethlehem asking, "Where is he who is born King of the Jews?" They were Persians who'd been trained in the school of the Magi, founded by Daniel, coming to look for the one that would be born at the time of the Romans. It's that simple. The Romans ruled during the days of Jesus, but the first contact we have with them is from Judas Maccabeus. And it's interesting that when Josephus, later on, after the times of Christ, when Josephus writes his two books, Antiquities and War, he is a Jew. And he's writing these two books to show how the Romans have been favorable to the Jews throughout the last two centuries, because a great war came between the Jews and the Romans in 66 AD, 36 years after Jesus was crucified and rose again. A great war came, and Josephus, who had been captured by the Romans, was writing to say, "Look, we don't need to fight. We've had good terms with the Romans." But I think it's fascinating that Judas Maccabeus is the first one to entreat the Romans for peace. And that was in 161 BC. So, for the next 25 years, the Maccabees continue to fight to throw off the Greeks. They have control of the Temple Mount, but they don't have all of the fortified cities. And so there's battles all over Judea, all over what we now call Israel, for the Maccabees to gain control. It's a 25-year battle from 167 to 142. And during this time, Judas Maccabeus dies, and his brother Jonathan takes the throne. And during the days that Jonathan takes the throne, he is another son of Mattathias. When Jonathan takes the throne, something happens that really disturbs the Jews. They've been supporters of the Hasmoneans. They've been supporters of Mattathias and his five boys. They've been supporters of the Maccabee revolt. They've been their heroes. But Jonathan takes the high priesthood. He takes it for himself. The high priest was the greatest official that the Jews could have. They had no king at this time. They were paying taxes to the Greek kings. He becomes high priest. You say, well, why is that a problem? Well, because you had very devout Jews called the Hasidim. Hasidim, H-I-S-I-D-I-M. In fact, today, a Hasidic Jew is that Jew that's got the curls that you see falling down right here and all that. He's a very devout Jew. It comes from the word Hasidim. The Hasidims of Jonathan's day were furious that someone who is not from the line of Zadok had become high priest. Who was Zadok? Zadok was the high priest, the descendant of Aaron, in the days of King David. And it was a law that all the high priests of Israel must be the firstborn son of the firstborn son of the descendant of Zadok. Jonathan breaks that law. It irritates the Hasidim so much that groups begin to form among the Orthodox. Groups like the Pharisees, who can't stand the Maccabees because they have appointed themselves as high priest. This is where the Maccabees come into, the Pharisees come into existence during the reign of Jonathan. Now, I don't have time to show you this tonight because we must move quickly. We only have about 6 or 7 more minutes. But during these battles that the Greeks are fighting with the Maccabees, they've got to pull their forces from the east to fight in Judea because the Maccabees, they're hammers. They are coming after them hard. And here's the thing. The Greeks did their little phalanx moves. They marched like this with armor and shields like this all together. And the Maccabees, you know what they did? They were guerrilla soldiers. They would dodge, 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 dodge. And they were wiping them out. The Greeks pulled all their forces from the east back to Judea. And because of that, there were revolts in the east. You remember the old Persian Empire that had been conquered by the Greeks? Well, they reformed under the name Parthia. And there's the rise of the Parthians. And this is important later on. And then there's another kingdom called the Bactrian Kingdom. The Seleucid Kingdom begins to break apart because they're fighting the Ptolemies and they're fighting the Maccabees. Now, the Roman Empire eventually conquers the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, and their great enemy in the days of Jesus is the Parthian Empire. We're going to talk about that in the time to come. When Jonathan is appointed high priest, as I shared with you, the Hasidim, the Orthodox, were furious because he wasn't a descendant of Zadok. The Jews believed that the high priest must be from the house of Zadok and that the king must be from the house of David. And the Hasmoneans were not from the house of Zadok and they were not from the house of David. In 142 BC, Jonathan dies. He is murdered by the Seleucid king. He's kidnapped and murdered. So his brother, Simon, the last surviving of the five sons of Mattathias, becomes high priest, ethnarch leader of Israel. And he negotiates independence. And in 142 BC, for the first time since Nebuchadnezzar conquered Israel in 586 BC, Israel becomes an independent nation. They don't pay taxes to anybody. But here's the thing. They still don't have a king. Simon reigns for 7 years. Then his son, John Hyrcanus, takes the high priesthood. Now, I don't have time to tell you how this happened in 135. But Simon, his wife, two of his other kids, travel from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he is murdered, and his kids are tortured, and his wife is mutilated because there are people who live in Jericho who are afraid that the high priest will become a descendant of the Maccabees. Simon is murdered by his own people, by his son-in-law, because they don't want the Maccabees to have the high priesthood. But you know what? Doesn't stop him. John Hyrcanus becomes the high priest. He's the son of Simon, and he reigns until 104 BC. Now, on this slide, you don't have time to write it. I'm going to give it to you next week in our study. During the Hasmonean period, from 167 BC, when the revolt begins under Mattathias, until it ends when King Herod takes the kingship of the Jews, and he's not even a Jew, he's an Idumean. For that 130 years, there's only 12 people who rule Israel. Only 12. Mattathias, it starts with him, goes to his son Judas Maccabeus, to his other son Jonathan, to his other son Simon. Then when Simon is murdered, Simon's son John Hyrcanus becomes high priest. And this is what's called the golden age of the Hasmoneans. Because the Greeks are now gone and the Jews begin to expand their territory under Hyrcanus. Hyrcanus has a son, Aristobulus, and I've got him in purple here on your slide because when John Hyrcanus dies, Aristobulus becomes high priest. Now get this. In 104 BC, Aristobulus becomes high priest, and then he says to the people, "I am now your king." And for the first time since Zedekiah lost his eyes, Israel as a king. But he's not from the house of David. And the Pharisees are so upset, they are about to go to war against their own people. Aristobulus suddenly dies after 1 year. He's sick, something's wrong with him. And his son, Alexander Janius, the brother of Aristobulus, comes to the throne and he marries Aristobulus' wife, Salome Alexandra. And this is where we're going to pick up next week, ladies. Salome Alexandra is a lady you need to know because when her second husband, The brother of her first husband dies. She becomes the only queen Israel has, other than the one you read about in the Old Testament. She becomes queen. And then here, her two sons, Aristobulus II and Hyrcanus II, they fight to take the throne when their mother dies. And it's during their fight, we'll talk about it next week, that the Romans intervene. General Pompey comes in and says, "You boys, what are you fighting over? What do you want?" And you know what he does? Pompey, you've heard of Pompey? He goes in to figure out what the boys are fighting over. He goes into Jerusalem and he enters into the temple because he thinks there's great treasure in there. This is what the sons of Salome Alexandra want. And the Jews never forgive the Romans for desecrating their temple. And this is the beginning of the Jews' animosity toward the Romans. You have Antigonus and Aristobulus III. Let me tell you about Aristobulus III, and I'll close with this. Aristobulus III is the last of the Hasmoneans. He is 17 years old. He is high priest. His grandfather is Hyrcanus. And he's good looking. He goes out to make the morning sacrifice in the year 36 BC. King Herod has just announced himself that he is now king of the Jews. And he watches as all the people fawn over Aristobulus III. And he is so scared that the people will want a Hasmonean to be king and not this Idumean interloper that he lures Aristobulus III at the age of 17 to Jericho, to his palace. And he orders his soldiers to drown him in the swimming pool behind his palace. Those of us who've been to Jericho, I wanted to go to the ruins this year to take a look where this happened. But he's the last scion, Aristobulus III. When Herod kills him, there's no more Hasmonean who can take the throne or the high priesthood. And this is King Herod, who reigns from 37 BC until 4 BC when the wise men come asking the question, "Where is he who is born king of the Jews?" Herod is now 70 years old, and he is still scared to death that somebody's going to supplant him as king of the Jews. And this is how we have Herod the Great becoming king of the Jews. He's the one who ended the Hasmonean dynasty. In order to get the Jews to like him, he builds up Jerusalem. He rebuilds the temple. He builds and fortifies Caesarea Philippi. He does all kinds. It's like I'm going to make this a great country so that you will like me. This is Herod the Great. Where is the one who's been born king of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. And Pilate asked Jesus before the crucifixion, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he said, "You have said so." Why is everybody asking, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Because for 150 years prior to Christ's coming, there's a great debate over who's king. The genealogy of Jesus in Matthew chapter 1 and in the book of Luke is important because it traces Jesus to the house of David. And when that is being written, it is showing that the Hasmonean kings were interlopers, that King Herod is an interloper, that the king, the true king of the Jews, in fact, the king of the world, is Jesus the Messiah. And everything written about Jesus in the Old Testament is fulfilled in his life and his actions. So, next week, part two of the Hasmonean dynasty, as we look at some of the most difficult time periods in the latter half of the Hasmonean rule. But I think at least this is becoming clear. There's a lot of history that takes place between the Testaments, and the world is getting ready for the coming of the Messiah. Okay, you've listened well. How many of y'all, just by a show of hands, we've got about 45 seconds to a minute. How many of y'all have ever heard this presentation before? Lift your hand. One? Wow. And that's probably in seminary, wasn't it? Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Okay, and now if you're sitting there thinking to yourself, what in the world? I mean, I have a hard enough time making sack lunches for the kids. What does this have to do with me? Well, here's the thing. If God is in control of history, centuries past, He's in control of your history now. And you can trust the King of Kings, who got the world ready with a common language, common roads, and a common culture for the spreading of the good news. All right, thank y'all. Good to have you, new ones. You're dismissed. See you next Wednesday night. Hey, by the way, let me say this. We are meeting next Wednesday night, part two. Then we'll have 1 week break for fall break. And then we'll come back with the Romans and finish up with the last 6 lessons.